Welcome to the Alex Katahakis podcast, the show where I sit down and speak with inspirational, thought-provoking authors, therapists, and sex experts to discover ways to help you live a happy, healthy life. Today, I'm talking with Harvard-educated author, speaker, and therapist Jenna Rimmersma, who's the founder and clinical director of the Atlanta Center for Relational Healing. Her new book, Altogether You, Experiencing Personal and Spiritual Transformation with Internal Family Systems, recently launched and was the number one bestseller spiritual self-help book on Amazon. In addition to her work as a therapist, Jenna holds a master's degree in public policy and worked on Capitol Hill as an influencer in the political arena. Join me today in listening to Jenna Rimmersma and her creative ideas about how to use internal family systems to help rectify some of the social pains that we're seeing today and to work from a more compassionate and connected place in relation to all those we meet.
Well, let me just start with this by saying that, you know, in the last 2 days, we've had this devastating news in the headlines about racial polarization. We've seen images in the news that are horrible and not new to us in this country also. And our current approach to race relations is not working. It's never worked. There's this gross bifurcation and separation and segregation. And so I'm curious about how your new book, Altogether You, which is a great title, by the way, for the work you're doing, you know, how it can inform and help us think about what's going on today.
Absolutely. Well, Altogether You brings together the concepts of internal family systems and the struggles that we all face both internally in our own internal worlds, things like anxiety, depression, addiction, as well as the struggles that we face in the groups that we are affiliated with, such as political, religious, and racial divisions.
And can you just define for our listeners what internal family systems is, because not everybody knows what that is?
Of course. Internal family systems, I'll use the term IFS to refer to it for brevity, is an evidence-based treatment intervention, which means that it has been clinically proven to be efficacious in clinical treatment of anxiety, depression, addictions, those types of things. But it's a relatively new way of understanding human functioning that helps us to really come to terms with the fact that we as human beings, and I would argue we as groups of human beings, are not monolithic. We are not a single monolithic entity, but rather we are comprised of multiple different parts or elements. And IFS argues that the warring of those parts, both within us as well as between us, are the root of all dysfunction and pain and suffering in the world. And I think it is incredibly germane as we consider what is happening in the headlines today. But IFS articulates that there are foundationally three aspects or core elements of who we are as human beings. And I would argue as a parallel process, who we are as groups of human beings. At our core, at our deepest core, is what IFS calls our self. And every tradition in world religion has a name for this. It might be referred to as the Imago Dei, or the God image within. Our Hindu friends refer to this as Atman. Sometimes it's called Buddha, or Prana, or Chi, or Flow. So there is this sense that at our core, who we truly are is authentically connected to a divine essence, a universal flow. And that when we are connected to that divine essence, which happens when all of the other parts of us relax and unblend or step back, so we access that which is always there intrinsically inside of us, that we spontaneously exhibit and exude what IFS would call the 8C qualities. And those are things that we need a lot more of right now in our headlines. Things like calmness, clear-mindedness, compassion, connectedness. And that's a huge one. There is no sense when we are in our core self of me versus you,
right,
or us versus them, or in-group and out-group. There is this deep sense of interconnectedness that we are human beings together on this journey of life. And if there is any enemy, it is the enemy of trauma that has come against us as human beings, but that we are fellow journeyers and travelers throughout life.
Right. I would add that every one of these traditions you're talking about, especially the non-dual Eastern traditions, talk about this separation. And when we create separation, that's when we create suffering. That's one of the ways that we create suffering. And from a neuroscience perspective, you're really pointing to what we call neural integration. That when these self circuits are disconnected, uncoupled, then we get these separate self states, or these what Philip Bromberg beautifully called not me states. So these states, they bear out, there are biological substrates for these states that you're talking about too.
That's exactly right. And the neurobiology of the healing work of internal family systems is very fascinating, because in the language of IFS, what you are describing is what IFS would say is referred to as the burdening of the parts, or the separating out and the burdening. And when that occurs, it happens because of trauma. So at our core, at our essence, we are comprised of a core self and many different unburdened parts. Those parts make us the unique person that we are. They contribute to our unique personality. Culturally, cultures and groups and racial groups have a core self or a core essence and unique parts, perhaps their musical traditions or religious activities that really make them uniquely who they are. And those are beautiful and unburdened. But what happens is when we experience trauma, any type of trauma, capital T trauma from addiction and abuse and neglect and violence, all the way to lowercase t trauma, the traumas that are less obvious, we develop parts called exiles that become burdened, and they lose access to their essential core qualities because they're overtaken by these burdens. And those burdens hold things like shame and fear and powerlessness and a sense that my feelings and needs don't matter, or I have no agency, I have no voice. And when that happens, other of our parts become burdened to try to protect us from that pain. And IFS would say that there are two types of protective parts. One are the managers that are proactive, and the other are the firefighters that are reactive. Mm-hmm. And the proactive manager parts are parts that try to prevent the pain of our exiles from ever getting activated. So as individuals, that might be things like people pleasing, control, doing everything perfectly. I articulate one type of a manager called a spiritualizer manager, which tries to do it right in the name of God, but is not really our core connection to the divine. But inevitably, because those parts are burdened, they may help the pain to be better in the short run, but 100% of the time in the long run, they make the pain worse. And when that happens, our reactive managers, or our reactive protectors have to jump in. And those are our firefighters. And those are a lot less desirable behavioral parts. These are things like all of the addictions, alcohol, drugs, sex, shopping, eating. These are things like suicidal ideation, homicidal ideation, self-harm, dissociation. And just as we as individuals have these proactive and reactive parts that try to protect us from pain, we also as groups have proactive and reactive parts that are burdened trying to help us with pain. And similarly, when we are acting as a culture or as a racial group or as a political party or as a religious organization out of burdened parts, we can know that we are only ultimately making the pain of our cultural exiles, our racial exiles, worse and not better, and therefore exacerbating the polarizations in our communities. And that's why the insights of IFS really are so applicable to the headlines that we are seeing today.
So interestingly, you know, I'm translating this through this lens of neuroscience as you're speaking, and we know that the left brain is very linear, it's highly critical, it's a defense against deeper affect and pain, and certainly is, you know, a party to pathological dissociation, which is really a disconnect between, you know, the high right cortex and the lower limbic areas. And so this system sounds like it's had a way of defining all of this in language that people can really relate to and start to be aware of internally to see how these different aspects, which are a whole host of, you know, neurochemical and visceral reactions, sort of come to be alive in a certain way. So that's really interesting to me too. So how would you say then this system or way of thinking, I'm very curious in the way you're thinking about it because it's expansive, how you think this system can help with social justice and conversations that are constructive for change, how this would be used by our, you know, local political leaders and global leaders.
Absolutely. Well, first to speak just briefly to the neuroscience piece, if you really look at what's happening when we're connected to self, which is, I would argue, the ideal state for us to engage in these very difficult and painful conversations, we are activating the orbital medial prefrontal cortex, which is in a very different way than it might typically activate, which would be in a repetitive, almost that looping kind of OCD sort of way. But what happens when we are in self is this expansiveness where the brain is literally connecting to all the different parts, the other regions and hemispheres of the brain in an expansive way. And similarly, the energy in our mirror neurons that we are activating in others is activating their expansiveness both within their own brain regions, but also in between us. And so it creates what Dr. Richard Schwartz, the founder of Internal Family Systems, refers to as an adaptive
connection. You know, hostile, it's defensive. We're both ready for war because, you know, as Stan Tatkin says, our brains are wired for love and war. And so as long as we're, you know, in this limbic base state, we're going to get the kind of conflict and division that we're getting now. But if you and I meet in this open-heartedness, in this integrated, suspended place of possibility, then we're both actually co-regulating each other and down-regulating the activated fight state. And now there's a possibility of meaning. And that's really challenging because of the level of really distortion, the fear and the hatred of other right now. And so that's, I'm just curious more and more about, you know, how we would start to intervene because it feels like we're in an inflection point right now with all of what's going on between the virus and the racial tension. And we're trying to evolve, I think, to something bigger and better.
That's right.
But we need leadership and, you know, where do we begin besides at home?
Exactly. Well, I would argue precisely there. It must begin within each of us before we can take it outside. And what I mean by that, and I unpack this much more in the book, but for the sake of the limitations of a singular podcast, I would argue that there are two immediate takeaways from IFS that we can use to really change and use this inflection point to bring our own self-leadership into a courageous voice of into these difficult conversations. The first point that I would make is take a U-turn. And the second point is speak for and not from. So again, I've written the book to be very, very readable by non-clinical individuals. And so my takeaways are very kind of basic. But what I mean by take a U-turn is asking ourselves the question, before we engage in the arena, what is coming up in me? Because when we are not in self, our energy is going outward toward another person. It may be going outward in hatred or fear or anxiety. It may be going externally to want to change someone else's behavior or get them to stop or start doing something. But before we can effectively engage in this conversation, we must take a U-turn and ask, what is coming up in me? And the way that we do that, I call it a spiritual MRI, is we ask the magic question of ourselves, what am I feeling toward fill in the blank? So how I can check to see if I am in self before I engage in this conversation is I can say, how, if I turn on the television and I see the broadcast of the heartbreaking activity that is happening and unfolding on our streets today, and I ask myself, how do I feel toward that broadcast or those people or that event? And my answer is, I'm afraid.
Yeah.
I'm enraged. Mm-hmm. I'm ashamed. I'm avoidant, I'm fearful, then I know I'm in a part and I'm not in self. And so the very first thing I must do is compassionately become curious about that part of me and learn why it is activated so that it can relax and unblend, if you will, and give me access to my core self, because it's from that place of core self that I can engage in the dialogue in a truly healing way. Once we have taken a U-turn, and that alone would change the entire dialogue. If every single person took a U-turn before we said anything, did anything, that right there would completely radically change what's happening. But easy takeaway number two of how can I bring leadership in a healthy way as an individual listening to this podcast into the racial conversation is speak for and not from. So number one, take a U-turn. Mm-hmm. Number two, speak for and not from. And what do I mean by that? What I mean is once I've identified the parts of me that are activated, then I speak on their behalf. So if I may give an example, just using my own parts.
Sure.
Because I can only speak effectively from my own experience. And I have to own that I have a lot of fear and trepidation around that because I am aware that this is such a difficult conversation. But I want to model what I'm inviting us to do. Mm-hmm. So if I were to inventory my own parts, if I were to take a U-turn and inventory the parts of me that come up around these racial conversations, I can identify, among others, numerous exiles. I have one exile that is terrified to say anything anywhere about racial issues because I'm white. And this part of me knows that I have absolutely no idea how traumatic it is to be a person of color in America and is very afraid of being judged and rejected and hated. Right. I have another exile that is very afraid of doing it wrong and further adding to racial pain by making some kind of misstep, especially in a public arena like a podcast. And I'm worried that, this exile part of me is worried if I use the wrong terminology or inadvertently say something that would be experienced as hurtful, then I would actually be making it worse and not better. I have a cultural exile that is filled with shame and horror when I see not only the atrocities that individuals in my racial group are currently perpetrating, but also flooded with shame and horror about the legacy of trauma that my cultural group has inflicted on people of color. And I have an exile that feels powerless because I'm just one person and I'm just a very small person. And this is such an enormous issue that it just feels overwhelming to this exile. So as a result of having these burdened exiles, I therefore will have burdened managers and firefighters that jump up to try to protect me and shield me from the pain of my exiles. I have one manager that would like me to avoid the topic entirely.
Sure, of course.
So, right. And I think in my cultural group, this is a strong one. When a news show comes up, this manager wants to turn off the television and say, let's just not watch that. That's really unpleasant. There's nothing we can do about it. Let's not talk about it.
Right. But that is also the what white privilege gives us. White
exactly.
privilege allows us to turn off the television and not think about it or talk about it. I don't want to get involved.
That's right. And notice that that is a burdened manager.
It is very burdened, yes.
And it's very different than my essential self, if I can be compassionate with that avoidant manager that I have of white privilege that wants to turn it off. And if I can understand that that manager in me is trying hard to help me with pain, so I'm not getting angry at that manager, I'm actually receiving it with compassion so it can relax. When I have access to my core self, I realize we are interconnected. When it is not well with my brothers and sisters in the streets of Los Angeles, it is not well with me, regardless of my immediate circumstances.
Right.
And so my number one goal is to recognize my parts and greet them with compassion, understand how they're trying to help me so that they'll relax and give me access to my self wisdom. I have another manager that's a perfectionist, and it tells me, if you're going to step into this conversation today, you better be absolutely sure that you make no mistakes and you say everything flawlessly. Otherwise, you're a total failure and a hateful racist. And this part is trying to help me do it right so that I won't be misunderstood and attacked. But again, not helpful. It's a burdened part. And finally, I have a burdened firefighter that's kind of waiting in the wings, so to speak, and it's watching what's happening. And it's sort of waiting for my perfectionist manager to screw up. And if I say something wrong or am inadvertently hurtful, it's going to jump in and try to take me out and say, you will never be a part of a conversation like this again. You need to stay small and invisible and quiet. It's trying to remove me from the line of fire. And that is not a helpful behavior, but it is a good part. And this is the radical, life-changing, perspective-changing insight of IFS, which is all parts of me and all parts of you and all parts of everyone. Perpetrators, people who are suffering, all parts of everyone are good, even if what they are doing is profoundly not good. And that allows me to see through their behavior to the core essence of who they truly are and receive them with compassion and curiosity and courage. And that's the self energy that we need to have to bring to this conversation to change the game.
Right. And this is a massive evolutionary calling. And again, it really is reflective of many, many faith traditions, non-dual traditions, this recognition that we are all one. And as you were talking about, you know, this self state, this centered state, which you could call a ventral vagal state, I was thinking about the heartbreak that we feel. You know, our hearts break 1,000 times a day when we really see and feel the pain of what's going on all over the world in different areas. And so managing that, if you don't have all these other compensatory parts running in and all their chatter about what's okay and what isn't, and we just let ourselves be present with what is, that is a heart opening, sort of a cracking open of the heart of deep compassion, I think. And that allows us to sit in a place of just being open to what's going on. And I think also, I mean, this is a personal belief that sort of consciousness is, you know, healing without doing anything per se. That doesn't mean we shouldn't engage in activism and make changes, but on a very small level and a powerful level, this act of being present with what is and compassionate and feeling the pain is changing the pain. It's just a very long, slow process.
Well, I would agree with that profoundly from many faith traditions, as well as principles of IFS, IFS directly states that it is the self and only the self that holds the power to heal our parts, mm-hmm. which is why access to it is so critical. And many faith traditions echo this, that yeah. the point of progressive meditation, in fact, is to arrive at this self state sure. that is profoundly healing. In a Christian tradition, we might say that it is the that power of the Holy Spirit that gives us the power to love our enemies and extend kindness to those who hurt us. That is, the healing presence comes from that divine or that core essence within us. And that is a game changer, because that core self, unlike our burdened parts, cannot be overwhelmed by the magnitude of grief and suffering. And that is fairly pivotal. And this is important as we do IFS therapy, uh-huh. Is that when we are in self, there is no amount of suffering or grief that a client can share that will overwhelm us. Right. Yeah. And that is true for us as well as we watch the suffering of the world. Our burdened parts are overwhelmed by it and become activated. They either shut down or they act out in an attempt to process the rage and the grief and the shame. And that is not true of our core self. Our core self can simply be present with it, mm-hmm. deep compassion, and without becoming overwhelmed or overtaken by it.
Hi, this is Alex. If you like what you're listening to, I encourage you to check out my book, Mirror of Intimacy, available on Amazon, along with my other books. Also, be sure to visit www.centerforhealthysex.com to learn more about the services we offer and subscribe to our daily Mirror of Intimacy meditation emails.
Don't you think when people are up against, you know, long-held defenses and they start to feel this abject pain they couldn't feel in childhood, that while they're feeling that feeling and having all of these emotions or affect, that the core self is always there. Mm-hmm. And it allows for the person to go into the depths of despair that we all are terrified of. And yet there is always some small, still voice, some part that's available that can hold us while we go into our pool of pain, as Marilyn Murray says. And without that, we actually couldn't really ever heal. So in some ways, that flame may not be a flame. It may just be an ember. Mm-hmm. But it's our job, I think, as therapists to help kindle that ember so that, you know, people can have this healing experience.
100%. The philosophy of IFS is that that core self is always there in all people all the time at 100%. But we simply lose access to it when our burdened parts jump up and take us over. And so, in fact, the goal is not even to create more of a flame or to fan something into being as a larger state, but actually to bring such compassion to our parts that they step back and give us more access to it. And that is so profound when we think about any human being who is engaged in literally any activity imaginable, to know that inside of that person at all times, in that very worst moment of their worst imaginable behavior, is a core self that is undamaged, that they just simply don't have access to in that moment. That is something that, when I think about people who are able to observe the other in that way, it causes me to think of people like the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., who could observe the other engaged in horrific atrocities and still, while not in any way, shape, or form articulating that the behavior was okay, because it's not,
right.
See who they are and hold compassion and love for the God image, for the self state that is within them, which at the end of the day, when I finish my yoga practice every day, mm-hmm. we say namaste, which conveys this, the God image in me sees and bows to the God image within you.
Right. Yeah. And for a therapist to hold that vision, to hold that knowing, is an incredible invitation also for the person to move towards their healing.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So do you have thoughts again about sort of where to begin and how we would bring these notions to our the broader culture and to start to have these conversations?
Yes, so I would sort of circle back to the first two points of take a U-turn and speak for and not from. Mm-hmm. Those are really the two takeaway action points that every individual can use today,
right,
as a way of beginning. Because if we are not starting from a place of self, with self-awareness of our parts that are influencing the way that we engage in this conversation, we will not be able to engage wisely or with a healing energy. Mm. Because even our burdened parts, who may be doing good things, for example, burdened managers that out of a sense of shame or guilt are over functioning in attending rallies or speaking or signing petitions, they are doing good things.
Right.
But they are burdened. They're trying to compensate for shame and pain. And so ultimately, that is not a place of self-led energy that is truly healing. But what I would argue beyond that, once we have taken those two steps and hopefully more to bring our core selves to this conversation, is I would argue, just as you and I work with betrayal trauma in our offices every day, when we have two parties and one party is the betrayer, it is incumbent on the betraying party to begin the process of owning and of speaking honestly their wrongs and of receiving the emotional impact from the betrayed partner. Mm-hmm. And making restitution. So I would say, similarly, the parallel process with us in racial conversations, those of us who are members of the dominant majority, who have been a part of the group that has inflicted the majority trauma, it is incumbent on us to show up in these conversations with initiative, to stand into the conversation first with self openness and compassion, and to say to people, I own that I have no idea what it is like to be you. Mm. I do not know what it is like for you to be here sitting across from me. Would you be willing to share with me what it's like to be you in America? What is it like to be you talking to me about race? I am white and you are a person of color. What does that feel like for you? How do I represent the atrocities of the generations that have gone before in your mind? What parts of you become activated? Tell me what that's like and how I can own that and make amends to you in to the degree that I'm able in a way that would feel meaningful. So it's on us as a majority group to initiate that process.
Well, I know, and I've been in lots of diversity conversations and communities, and I know oftentimes marginalized people don't want to educate white people about what their experience is like.
Yes.
And so that can be a very tricky invitation, because there might be people who have hostile parts who say, why do I have to educate you? Why don't you just take ownership of what your part is in this? So again, I think these would be, this would take a while, and they could be very tricky conversations, because white people can come across looking like do-gooder white people.
Yes.
For their own aggrandizement or to make themselves feel less burdened or less guilty.
Right. Exactly. And you can tell the spirit, what type of part someone is speaking from when they are speaking across from you. Mm-hmm. And if it is coming from a burdened place. And I'm really glad that you brought that point up, because this would not be asking someone to educate us about the wrongs that have happened. This is asking about their individual experience, their felt experience in the room.
Right.
So in other words, what is it like to be you, which is a question that is a question of deep intimacy. Mm-hmm. How is it for you to sit across from me? Not necessarily educate me about all the harms that have come to you. We need to start with ownership and our own education around that. But I want to try, if I can, to understand your felt experience. And if my even being here is deeply offensive, would you be willing to tell me about that?
Yeah, that's nice. Yeah, I think that really starts to make a safe space to say, I can take it. I can take your, and this parallels the betrayal trauma, to say, I can take your rage. I can take your dislike of me because I did this to you. And maybe I personally didn't do it, but my group, my white cultural group, did this to you eons ago. And yet we've never made restitution to the African-American community ever. And so, you know, this whole icon of the angry black man is just disgusting to me, because why wouldn't the black man be angry? Right. Why would he be anything else when he can be shot for jogging while black?
That's right.
Right? And so there's so many, it's just such a complexity. As we were talking, I thought, wow, what would it be like to start IFS community groups all over the country? And how would you create a network of starting to invite a conversation, even if it was on Zoom now, so people don't have to leave their houses, where people can just sort of show up and be in these conversations for change, or people of color can listen to white people grapple with all of our guilt, our shame, our paralyzation around why we don't do anything, why we're not doing better. And of course, ultimately, this comes to leadership. It becomes very political.
Well, it does. And I think that IFS informs our awareness of what is happening politically. Because when we realize that the more burdened our cultural exiles are, the more burdened our cultural managers and firefighters must necessarily be, that 100% explains the increasing polarization of our political leadership and our communities, because the greater the pain of the cultural exiles, the greater the activity of the unhelpful protector strategies that our political leaders will have to engage in. And so what might otherwise appear to be a rather baffling and inexplicable political experience unfolding before us begins to make a tremendous amount of sense when we recognize what's happening from a parts awareness using IFS principles politically.
Can you say more about that, more sort of explicitly?
Absolutely. So if I am an individual, this may take just a moment to explain, but bear with me, because I'm really articulating a parallel process that is difficult to grasp. But our parts function the same way inside of us as individuals and inside of our groups. So if I am a human being and I have experienced a trauma, and I have developed as a result of that trauma an exile that feels, let's say, shame, powerlessness, and fear, I will then develop a burdened manager or a burdened firefighter or a host of them to cope with that. So one way that I might cope with that shame is to cut myself off from people who could activate that shame. So I might isolate, or I might cut off or avoid. Another way that I might cope with that is to become very narcissistic. I might become very self-aggrandizing and make draw lots of attention to myself to try to overcome that. I might become very abusive verbally. I might lash out because I'm trying to compensate for the pain. That part of me, that burdened part, is trying to compensate for the pain of those exiles. So similarly, in the way that that might happen inside of an individual, we also see that parallel process happening in communities. So if as a community, generationally, we have a legacy, we have cultural, racial exile legacies that stem from things like slavery, chronic poverty and violence in communities. Now we have racial cultural exiles that are burdened with things that are very similar to our individual exiles, like fear, powerlessness, hopelessness, a sense that no one will be there for me. And so culturally, our leadership within the culture then takes on those extreme burdened roles as a direct reflection of the burdening of the cultural exiles, just as happened internally for me as an individual. So what we will see is the more cultural pain we have, the greater the pain of the cultural exiles, the greater the unhelpful coping of the, in this case, what we're discussing, the political leadership or the political parties may engage in very similar behavior, cutting off, building walls, right. Narcissism, aggression, lashing out, minimizing, denying, us versus them. Those types of things are going to escalate to the degree that the pain of the exiles is unaddressed. So to the degree that we have not, as a dominant culture, made any type of amends to our brothers and sisters of color, that will continue to polarize and escalate. And so as we look at kind of political polarization, and at least I do become very, let's say, curious about how we have come to be where we are, it begins to make sense when we look at it through the lens of polarized parts.
Yeah, and the divide keeps getting more and more extreme, and then it leads to violence.
Yes.
Which just perpetrates the cycle of trauma all over again, like a whole new generation of it.
Exactly.
And I think, you know, for those of us that are sort of empathic or open-hearted or grounded in ourselves, it just becomes writhingly painful to even listen to the news. And for me, I start to feel even increasingly more helpless in the face of that. And so that's why I wonder sometimes, like, where is this headed? And how do we intervene on it now? You know, we always intervene on things, it seems like, as human beings, when we're just in so much pain. It's like an addict who has to hit bottom before they get better. We don't seem to be motivated towards pleasure, towards sort of rectifying something as much as we are as getting out of an escaping pain.
That's right. And I love what you shared, that the more painful it becomes and the more difficult and overwhelming it is to watch what's happening on the news unfolding in front of us, the more overwhelmed and powerless we feel, and the more our burdened, just there's nothing I can do, let's shut down parts jump in. And so when we can become aware of that, we simply bring our self energy to those parts of us. Now, that may sound really counterintuitive. Mm-hmm. How is it that me engaging more compassionately with an other requires me to start with engaging more compassionately with myself?
Well, of course.
Yeah. That seems very narcissistic and counterintuitive, but the reality is, if I cannot compassionately engage my hopeless part, and the part of me that just has no idea what to do and so gets frozen, I have no prayer of compassionately connecting with the other who is being traumatized on those news screens. Sure. So in a very counterintuitive way, I must extend that compassion and care to my own parts first so that I can gain self-energy. And my self-energy will not be overwhelmed with that. It is not part of the quality of self to be overwhelmed and shut down. And so when I gain access to my core self, I suddenly become deeply courageous, curious, connected, and that is the place from which I can speak. If I'm called to speak in toward justice, or if I'm called to help articulate boundaries for righteousness, or if I'm called to go to my neighbor who is a person of color and ask if I can shop for groceries for them. It does not have to be a big dramatic action, although we would like it to be oftentimes, because when we feel so hopeless, we feel like a huge action is needed. But we each then in our self-energy have that calm awareness and the courage to make a difference in the arena and environment and with the people where we are and where we're called to be.
Yeah, that's beautiful. And then we can walk with compassion. I was thinking it's sometimes easier to make the association of the violence we perpetrate on ourselves. You know, if you drop something and you call yourself stupid or I'm an idiot, mm-hmm. that is then perpetrating violence on others because you will treat others in the self same way you treat yourself.
Exactly.
Right. So being compassionate starts at home. Before we can be compassionate with others, because otherwise it will feel patronizing or, you know, false in some way.
That's right.
So can you tell us a little bit about how you came to write All Together You, and how you corralled all of your parts to become together, to write the book? That's why I think the title is just so spectacular for what you do.
Well, it's a rather spectacular story. I will say that in a nutshell, about 3 years ago, I have a pattern of getting up in the morning and spending time in the quietness of the early hours with my higher power and a cup of coffee and my dog. And I began to feel a pull, a physical pull in my stomach. Very unusual, and it got my attention right away. And I just knew it was my higher power asking me to do something, but I didn't know what it was. And so every day I came back and sort of open-handedly in a meditative way said, okay, I'm listening. What is it that you want me to do? And got nothing. And this went on every single day for a year.
You're persistent, right?
As the year drug on, I got more and more irritated with my higher power. Uh-huh. And I started getting stompy, and I finally said, okay, if you're not going to tell me, I will help you out. And so you can either stop pulling my gut or you can tell me what you want me to do. So I got out a legal pad and a pen, and I put one idea on each page of the legal pad and a pro-con list, just in case God needed some help with that. And I wrote out probably 10 or 15 ideas, most of which had to do with business or other things. And on the very last page, I wrote Martina Luther. And that's sort of a joke, like a female play on Martin Luther, meaning bringing a radical message to faith communities. Oh. And I pointed to that page and I put a great big X across that that page of the legal pad. And I said, God, this is the one idea I will not do.
Oh.
And that was the birthplace of All Together You.
I see.
Because it is a message of radical grace and compassion for all of our parts. Mm. And that starts with the divine image within us. And that is not always a message that is well received in all faith communities. In many faith communities, yeah. It is. And in some, that is radical, and that we are fundamentally the essence of the divine, and there is goodness at our core.
Yeah, that does really hit right up against the original sin notion, doesn't it?
It does. And I don't argue against original sin. Mm-hmm. I just argue that it is held by the burden of our parts, not by our core self.
Sure.
And that's fairly radical for a lot of theological perspectives. Mm-hmm. And so it started there and really bringing a message of compassion and grace and healing to our faith experience, and particularly to people who've been wounded by faith communities, wounded by struggles, mental health struggles, with struggles politically, spiritually, socially, racially. The book is fairly comprehensive, and it starts with how we relate to ourselves and how we relate to God, and then how that impacts how we relate to others, and then how we relate to each other, group to group, and society to society, and culture to culture. So it starts from the small and goes to the large, and it was certainly a labor of love.
Sounds like it. Well, it sounds like a beautiful book, and I hope everybody who's listening reads this book, because it sounds like the world could use it based on what you're saying. So the title of the book is All Together You, Expanding Personal and Spiritual Transitions, is that right?
Experiencing personal and spiritual transformation with internal family systems therapy.
Yeah, thank you. Sorry, I goofed that. I can't even read my own handwriting. So we'll have more information for listeners also at the end of this podcast. But is there anything left that you would like to add that maybe we didn't cover in this hour?
I think if I just had one message for anyone who was listening, it would be that all parts of you, even the parts of you that you're most ashamed of, even the parts of you that feel the things that you don't want to feel and do the things that you wish you didn't do and can't seem to stop, all parts of you are good and all parts of you are welcome.
That's beautiful. Thank you. So thank you, Jenna, for being with us. And again, you can find her book on Amazon.com and we'll give you all that information.
Thanks so much, Alex. A pleasure to be here.
Yeah, thank you.
If you liked this episode, be sure to like it, subscribe, and leave a rating or a comment. You can find our other episodes on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Spotify, and alexkatahakis.com. Follow me at Alex Katahakis on Twitter and Instagram. Thank you for listening to the Alex Katahakis podcast. Remember that loving deeply begins with loving yourself.